Welcome to the SRB RISC e-learning webinar series, Tools for PFAS Site Characterization. This is the second session, PFAS Sources and Mapping. This webinar is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. My name is Mohammed Atiyah Ibrahim. I'm a researcher with the United States Environmental Protection Agency, Office of Research and Development within the Center for Environmental Solutions and Emergency Response. We will get started in a few minutes, and while we wait for others to log on, I would like to cover a few housekeeping items. Next slide, please. Okay, so when you registered for today's seminar, you should have received a confirmation email with instructions to join us for the live event. We also sent these same details in a reminder email yesterday. Those emails will both point you to the seminar webpage. I encourage you all to check that out since they have important pieces of information, including the session description, contact information of our speakers, link to download the presentation material, as well as options to browse through related websites. There is even an option to provide feedback to after the webinar today. Next slide, please. So the session is being hosted using Zoom webinar for those already familiar with Zoom meetings. So you should find this very similar interface. Audio would be available online with your device speaker or headphones. You may also listen by telephone. Regardless of how you listen, all participants in our webinar will be automatically be muted. We will not be using the chat feature in today's webinar. Instead, you will have the, if you have a question, comment, or you need to report of any technical issue, please press the Q&A button. You can use that window to privately submit feedback at any time. Closed captioning is available for this webinar. Also remember that our session today is being recorded. You will receive an email when the recording becomes available. Lastly, I encourage you all to stay with us until the end of the meeting. We will cover a few important reminders, such as how to share your feedback on this webinar. Next slide, please. So with these brief reminders, let's take a quick look on the Zoom webinar interface. First, in the lower left, you will find the audio controls, which allows you to select and adjust your preferred method for listening to today's session. In the main center portion or of your screen, you'll find you can view the presentation materials. In the far right of your screen, you will be able to view our presenters and moderators. In the upper right corner, you'll have the options to enlarge the presentation. On the bottom middle of the screen, you should see a toolbar which has option to access closed captioning as well as the Q&A. There is options in the Q&A window that you can anonymously ask questions. If you do not check that button when you send any anonymous message, your name will be visible with your message that you submit. So next slide, please. This presentation has been provided by as part of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency webinar. The documents do not constitute to EPA policy. Mentioning of any trade names, commercial products does not constitute endorsement or recommendations for use. Links to any non-EPA websites do not imply any official EPA endorsement or a responsibility for opinions, ideas, data, or products presented at those locations. They don't also guarantee the validity of the information provided. Links to non-EPA servers are provided solely as a pointer for information that might be useful for EPA staff and public. Okay, next slide. With this, it is my pleasure to introduce our speakers. We will start with Dr. Mark Brusu, a professor in School of Environmental of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Arizona, with joint appointments in the Soil, Water, Environmental Science Department and the Hydrology and Water Resources Department. Dr. Bruce's research specializes in the transport characterization and remediation of contaminants in the subsurface. With this, Mark, I will turn it to you.
Okay, thank you very much. My slide showing okay?
Yes.
Okay. It's a pleasure to be participating in this webinar. So I'd like to acknowledge my various collaborators and funding sources. Okay, first I will start with a brief refresher on PFAS molecular properties. So PFAS contain fluorine atoms bonded to carbon atoms. According to the recent definition from the OECD, a molecule must contain at least one fully fluorinated methyl or methylene carbon atom to be considered a PFAS. And based on a recent compilation from the EPA CompTox dashboard, there are greater than 14,000 different PFAS in existence. A critical property of PFAS is that many of them are amphiphilic and therefore behave as surfactants. In the diagram in the left, we have a typical structure of a surfactant where we have a polar head group circled in blue and a nonpolar tail in the red rectangle. For the case of PFAS, this nonpolar tail is comprised of fluorinated carbon chain rather than a hydrogenated carbon chain. And therefore, PFAS as surfactants have a propensity to adsorb at air, water, and other fluid-fluid interfaces. A unique property of PFAS is that the chains are both hydrophobic and oleophobic, which provides both water and oil repellency. So in terms of surfactants, PFAS comprise all of the primary types of head groups, including anionic, cationic, zwitterionic, and nonionic. In addition, PFAS have different tail structures. So first of all, we have perfluoroalkyls versus polyfluoroalkyls, where the former, all of the carbons are fully fluorinated in the chain, whereas for polys, they are not. In addition, we have straight chain versus branched tails. And of course, we have different chain lengths. Often we refer to them as the short chain versus long chain. So here are some examples of the different types of structures we have for PFAS, just a few of many, many different types of structures. So these differences in molecular structure impart great variability to the physicochemical properties of PFAS. So for example, we have orders of magnitude ranges in aqueous solubility, partition coefficients, and other physicochemical properties. So before moving on to examine how the molecular structures of PFAS influence transport and fate, which is the focus of our research group, I wanted to mention one other critical property, and that is that many PFAS are quite persistent in the environment due to the very, very strong carbon-fluorine bond. And so I won't be talking about this today, but I believe it will come up in the forthcoming presentations. So these unique properties provide the opportunity to employ PFAS for many different applications. However, these same unique properties cause the characterization and modeling of PFAS transport and fate to be very complex. And so to characterize and model PFAS transport and fate accurately, we really need to understand these unique properties and how they influence their behavior in the environment. So as we see from this schematic from ITRC, once PFAS are released into the environment, we have many modes of transport and fate to deal with. So a major focus of our research group is the transport and fate of PFAS in soil, the vadose zone, and groundwater. And so that's what I'll be focusing on. So as we mentioned, many PFAS behave as surfactants. And so in the vadose zone, of course, by definition, we have, under many conditions, air-water interfaces present. And so the adsorption of PFAS at the air-water interface has multiple ramifications. One of them is the potential to cause surfactant-induced flow, and another is increased retention and retardation for transport and leaching. So what is surfactant-induced flow? In the diagram on the upper left, we have a typical measurement of surface tension as a function of the aqueous concentration of, in this case, PFOS. And of course, we see as we increase the concentration in solution, we have more and more of the surfactant adsorbing at the air-water interface, which reduces the surface tension. Now, as we move from the measure data over to the right, we can see that the capillary pressure can be influenced by changes in surface tension. And so if we have sufficient amount of surfactant present at the air-water interface to reduce the surface tension sufficiently, we can cause water flow, which is what we term surfactant-induced flow. So if we have surfactant-induced flow occurring, this results in transient flow conditions, which can impact transport of any solute present in solution. It also changes the local water saturation, which changes the magnitude of air-water interfacial area present, and which can then impact the magnitude of retention by air-water interfacial adsorption, which we'll be talking about next. So as a result, this behavior results in a complex interconnected flow and transport that we need to consider in some cases. Now, another primary attribute of this surfactant behavior is fluid-fluid interfacial retention. So as we mentioned, in the vadose zone, we have air-water interfaces typically present. And so adsorption at the at these air-water interfaces then is another source of retention, as we can see in this retention model here in this box model and in the diagram on the left. In addition, if there happens to be immiscible organic liquids or NAPL present in the source zones, we can also have interactions of PFAS with that NAPL, including adsorption at NAPL water interfaces, but I won't be talking about that today. So what is the impact of air-water interfacial adsorption on transport of PFAS in unsaturated soils in the vadose zone? Well, here that's illustrated here in a set of miscible displacement or column experiments where soil is packed in the column, and we saturate that packed column with synthetic groundwater solution, and then we introduce a pulse of, in this case, PFOS. And then we measure the resultant breakthrough curve, which is shown here as the relative concentration measured in the effluent divided by the input concentration and the number of pore volumes, the relative time. And the blue triangles represent the result of an experiment conducted under these saturated conditions. Then we partially desaturate that column, thereby forming some air-water interfaces within that now unsaturated column. Then we repeat the experiments, and now we have the yellow and red circles representing the breakthrough curves for PFOS under these unsaturated conditions. And we can clearly see significant retardation of PFOS due to the adsorption at the air-water interface. Another way to illustrate the impact of air-water interfacial adsorption is through mathematical model simulations. And so here I'm showing a set of simulations conducted for a model fire training area where we have PFOS transport in a soil that we work with a lot. And so on the right-hand side figure, we have a plot of the leaching front for PFOS at four different times, plotted along a 5 meter depth interval of vadose zone. And we can see that the leaching front here represented by these different lines. And so here's 1 year, 2 years of leaching, 5 years and 10 years. And so we can see the leaching front reached groundwater within 5 years for the case with no air water interfacial adsorption included in the simulation. However, on the left-hand side now, we include air water interfacial adsorption, and we can see then that the propagation of the leaching front is greatly delayed, where it arrives in approximately 35 years. So an increase of a factor of 7 in the retention time, if you will, or travel time. So in many cases, depending on site conditions and the type of PFAS present, air water interfacial adsorption can be a significant contributor to retention in the Vado zone. So how do we quantify this retention? So here's, everyone is familiar with the standard retardation factor, which we can use to examine the distribution of solutes such as PFAS between the aqueous phase, sorbed phase, solid sorbed phase here with the standard KD. And then of course we have to modify it to include this new term representing adsorption at the air water interface, where KW is the air water interfacial adsorption coefficient and AW is the air water interfacial area. So what factors influence this term here in the blue rectangle? Well, first of all, we have air water interfacial area, and that's a function of both soil properties and the water saturation. So in this data set here, we see, first of all, as we go from on the x-axis from right to left, we are reducing the water content, which is increasing the amount of air present, increasing the air water interfacial area present. And we see it's a nonlinear function of water content. Secondly, we have measurements for multiple media, and the two curves on the upper section here with the largest air water interfacial areas are for media with the finest grains, the smallest diameter grains, and the smallest values are for the coarsest media. And so again, air water interfacial area is a function of both soil properties and water saturation, which greatly complicates its characterization and measurement in the field in particular. In terms of the air water interfacial adsorption coefficient, or KAW, we use quantitative structure property relationship analysis to evaluate the influence of PFAS molecular structure on this KAW. And so in this figure, I'm plotting measured log KAW values for 61 PFAS comprising all different structure types. As we can see here in the legend, we have data for PFCAs, PFSAs, branched, polys, cationic, zwitterionic, non-ionic, and even alcohols, and then a few hydrocarbon surfactants for comparison. And what we observe is a nice uniform correlation between log KAW and the molar volume. And the molar volume, this descriptor, represents the size of the molecular cavity created in solution. And so this uniform correlation that we observe here is indicating that adsorption at the air-water interface is being driven by the hydrophobic interaction mechanism, as we would expect. One last thing to point out is that if we look at the measured values for the shortest chain PFAS compared to the longest chain or largest PFAS, we see a 9-order of magnitude range in KAW values. So how does this reflect the transport behavior, retardation and transport? And so here are results from another set of column experiments where all the conditions are the same, except we have three different PFAS of different molecular sizes. And we observe here that the retardation is greatest for PFOS, the largest molecule, and it's smallest for GenX, the smallest molecule. Now, moving on to solid phase sorption, this is another significant retention process for many PFAS under many conditions in soil in the Vado zone. And as we all know, geomedia are geochemically as well as physically heterogeneous, where we have multiple potentially reactive constituents such as organic matter, metal oxides, and clay minerals. And as a result of this heterogeneity, we have the potential for multiple sorption mechanisms influencing PFAS solid phase sorption, as illustrated in this diagram on the right. So similar to the air, water, interfacial area data sets, we can conduct QSPR analysis of PFAS solid phase sorption. And so here is a set of data from six different studies where they conducted batch experiments to measure the sorption of both long chain and short chain PFAS by a range of soils and sediments comprising a wide range of properties. And so we have here the log KOC plotted as a function of molar volume. And we observe that the long chain PFAS appear to exhibit a uniform correlation to molar volume, similar to what we observed for air water interfacial absorption. In contrast, however, we see that for most of the short chain PFAS, they exhibit enhanced or greater sorption compared to what we would predict using the long chain correlation. However, we see great variation in this magnitude of enhanced sorption of the short chain PFAS. So delving further into the measurements, we have here plotted on the bottom left, log KOC as a function of molar volume for several sets of soils with different organic carbon contents. So if we look at the data measured for the red circles here, we see that the short chain PFAS, the open circles, exhibits consistent sorption behavior with the long chain correlation. And this happens to be for soils with very large relative organic carbon contents. Then as we go up this legend to smaller and smaller organic carbon contents, we see greater and greater deviation from the long chain correlation. So indicating that the magnitude of organic carbon content present greatly impacts the magnitude of the short chain PFAS sorption. On the right hand figure, we have log KOC plotted for two soils with similar organic carbon contents, but greatly different silt and clay contents. And we can see clearly that the adsorption of the short chain PFAS is much greater for the soil with high silt and clay compared to low silt and clay. So in total, the results of these data sets indicate that sorption of the long chain PFAS is mediated primarily by hydrophobic interaction process and interactions with organic carbon of the soil. However, the short chain sorption is strongly influenced by the amount of organic carbon and the amount of silt and clay, indicating that multiple sorption mechanisms are involved. Okay, so how do these lab studies translate into the field? So one way to examine retention behavior in the field is to compare soil concentrations to pore water concentrations. So several studies have recently reported measurements of both soil concentrations concurrent with pore water concentrations. So first, if we look at the equation, the top equation on the right, we see that the ratio of soil concentration to pore water concentration is a function of the retardation factor. And as I just went through the bench scale data sets, we observed that the KD, or the log KOC, and log KOW are both functions of molar volume. So if the retention behavior in the field follows similarly to what we have determined in the lab, we would anticipate that there would be a correlation between the concentration ratios and molar volume. And indeed, that's what we observe here in the figure, where we've plotted data sets from three studies where pore water and soil concentrations were measured independently for soil samples. And so these data provide some evidence that PFAS is distributing between soil and pore water as anticipated, at least for these three systems. And then finally, here's another field data set where we collected soil concentrations, PFAS concentrations for 124 cores from 30 different AFFF sites. And to be included in this data set, at least 8 depth discrete samples needed to be collected and analyzed for each borehole. And the depth interval spans from the ground surface to the top of the saturated zone or the groundwater. And so looking at the figure on the y-axis, we have the normalized sample depth. So bar one represents the shallowest surface soil sample. Going down to sample 8 represents a vadozone sample collected immediately above the water table. And then the extent of the bar represents the total mean normalized concentration of all analyzed PFAS. And so what we observe, first of all, is a significant decrease in concentration with depth. And second, we see that the concentrations of long-chain PFAS in blue represent a much larger fraction for the shallow intervals, whereas the short-chain PFAS in red represent larger fractions for the deeper intervals. And so these data provide evidence of both downward migration of PFAS and chromatographic separation, wherein the shorter chain PFAS have less retention and retardation, as we would anticipate based on the bench scale experiments and mathematical modeling data sets I showed earlier. So before ending, I just want to mention that there's many other factors that can influence PFAS transport and leaching in the vadozone, including physical heterogeneity, preferential flow, presence of colloids in solution. Of course, most sites, we have PFAS mixtures to deal with. Also, at many sites, we may have co-contaminants, and then precursors and other non-characterized PFAS. So in summary, so far, we've identified and developed an initial understanding of the relevant transport processes. So now we need to see how we can translate this knowledge into practice, into characterizing and understanding transport at the field scale. So thank you very much.
Perfect. Thanks, Mark, for the very informative presentation. So I'll just remind everyone that please go ahead and submit your question using the Q&A pod that you find on your screen. But we have time and we have enough questions to discuss. So Mark, I will read some questions for you that we got, and so we can discuss it in
this
Q&A time. So first question, how might the unique properties of PFAS influence the regulations such as determining the soil screening levels?
Yes. So one way we can address that is to consider what retention or retardation processes are considered in the standard models and methods that we currently use to determine soil screening levels. And we know that they do not include, for example, air-water interfacial adsorption, which, as I showed here, can be quite important for PFAS in unsaturated conditions, like in the vadozone. So we would probably want to include that process in revised models that we would use to determine soil screening levels.
Perfect.
And so we've actually done that recently, and the resultant values can vary quite significantly from what we would determine with the standard models, of course, depending on particular PFAS and soil conditions.
Yeah, I'll just pick it up from there. When you mentioned about the air-water interfacial adsorption can be important for PFAS transporting soil. But is air-water interfacial adsorption relevant to other transport and fate processes?
Yeah, so that's a good question. We know that there can be significant, for example, significant atmospheric transport of PFAS, and one of the potential mechanisms for that process is the presence of PFAS associated with aerosols. And so there's been quite a few bench scale studies conducted showing that the majority of PFAS mass associated with aerosols is present at the air-water interfaces, these micro, for the micro droplets, there's significant air-water interface. And so that's one area where it can be important for surface water bodies. Of course, we can have extensive air-water interfaces at that atmospheric water interface, and we can have an accumulation of PFAS there. And then there's now remediation methods have been proposed, such as fractionation, foam fractionation of soil to of PFAS to remove them from soil and groundwater. And so that is based on adsorption at air water interfaces.
Perfect. So we have some specific question about your experiments, actually. So the PFAS transport experiment that you mentioned with the soil column saturation, what was the absolute concentration of PFOA in terms of parts per billion or similar?
So we've conducted these types of experiments using a wide range of PFAS concentrations from 1 microgram per liter all the way up to, say, 10 milligrams per liter. So we've covered several orders of magnitude in concentrations.
Okay. Another very specific question. Why do the cationic PFAS tend to have the highest K depth? Like the values are apparently the highest there. They have
I
you
wonder
have
if
you know
that's
that?
in relation to this figure, perhaps.
Yeah.
So it's primarily a function of the size of the tail or the chain of the PFAS. So it just so happens that here the cationic are here with the brown asterisks. And so their molecular structures just happen to be quite large tails, comprise quite large tails. And so their molar volumes are on the larger size compared to many of the PFCAs, for example, and PFSAs. So, in terms of adsorption at the air water interface, it's not really directly influenced by the head group, but it's more by the size of the tail. However, for solid phase sorption, that cationic functional group, as we know, can exhibit greater adsorption because of its potential interactions, electrostatic interactions with soil constituents.
So for your previous tests so far, have you studied relations or interactions with heavy metals containing content in the soil, especially with clay?
The only metal PFAS system we've examined so far is chromium. So we conducted sorption and transport experiments with chromium and PFAS present concurrently, and we did see some impacts of the presence of chromium on PFAS sorption. So there did appear to be some interaction. Say the chromium, presence of chromium influencing the ability of the soil to adsorb PFAS. These were
So,
anionic PFAS.
okay. So yeah, it would be species specific, I believe, right? Okay, so does the soil type being either an electron donor or electron acceptor determine the bonding of the PFAS to the soil substrate? Also, if the PFAS chain length factor into the absorption of these compounds?
Yes, definitely. So, as we mentioned here for this diagram on the bottom left, we know that soils and sediments are have many different types of constituents. And so, for example, metal oxides their 0 point of charge for some of the metal oxides are in the range of environmental pHs. And so if there is something that causes a change in the pH, then we can cause a difference or a change in the polarity or surface charge of the metal oxides, right? So that can then affect the magnitude of electrostatic sorption interactions. And there has been some studies where they've changed the pH and then they observed, for example, increased sorption as they reduced the pH. So yes, it definitely can have an impact.
I think it's more of a suggestion. So for your correlation, one could use both molar volumes and the PFAS hydrophobicity factor. Did you attempt to make such relations?
I'm not quite sure what's meant by the bulk molar volume, because this is the what I would consider a bulk molar volume, because it's determined as it can be measured, or you can calculate it by the ratio of the molar mass and the density.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. So the next question, do you have a sense of how much of the apparent chromatographic separation observed in the field study may be related to differences in timing of release?
Well, that's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a little difficult to answer, of course, because these data all represent AFFF sites where PFAS was primarily used many years ago, and each site may have different time frames where they stopped using it, et cetera, of course, and different timings of when it was used for training, et cetera. But we try to normalize for that by having all of these in normalized depths and the normalized concentrations. So again, it would be difficult to determine individually because of all of the unknown factors, but just looking at it from high above first order is what we're trying to do, observing these differences. But yeah, and for a particular site, the timing of release, the amount of release, when it was last used, of course, could have a significant impact on the observed leaching behavior. Yeah, for sure.
Yep. So the next question says, what is understood about transport behavior at the air-water interface and downgrading in the vetus zone of cationic PFAS found in impacted soils?
So if we go back to this figure, in some ways, we have a relatively simple situation for air-water interfacial adsorption itself in terms of the surface activity, because it appears, at least based on this pretty large data set of all different molecular structures, that we can predict the Kaw for pretty much any type of PFAS based on its molar volume. But once we go from the lab into the field, we not only have Kaw to worry about, but we have air-water interfacial area to worry about, which, as we see from this graph, is a strong function of the water content and soil properties. And so if we have difficulty in measuring the soil saturation, soil moisture at a site, or if it's changing with time or in space, right, and the soil properties are changing, that's going to complicate determining air-water interfacial adsorption overall. And then, of course, for cationic, we may have complications in terms of solid phase sorption as well. So it can become quite complicated as we add in these different processes, and in particular for cationic and zwitterionic PFAS.
Yep, thank you. So the next question says why there is a this proportional decrease in PFAS species with depth?
So if we look at the length of the red bars, we see that magnitude of the length is somewhat similar for all of the different depth intervals, right? And so we are seeing that the short chain don't have significant retention. And we would expect that if we jump back. I'm sorry for jumping back and forth, but it's helpful having these figures. So we can see, for example, for PFBA, here's PFBS, the yellow one here. We see that they have very, very small log kWs. So they, in essence, have very small adsorption at the air-water interface. And in addition, if we come down to look at solid phase sorption, depending on the soil, they may also have relatively smaller magnitudes of solid phase sorption. And so we would anticipate that, and then we see that, like for example, here as well, that the short chain, right, they have much smaller ratios, meaning much smaller retardation factors. And so we would anticipate that short chain PFAS would have much greater ability to leach or migrate more rapidly through the vadosome. In comparison, we can see that the lengths of the blue bars, the long chain PFAS, they're much, much greater for the shallower intervals, and they get smaller and smaller as we go in depth. And so this is indicating that we're having significant retention of the long chain PFAS in the upper intervals of the soil profile. And typically, we're assuming that the PFAS was released on the land surface. And so, because of the very large kW values for the long chain PFAS, right, orders of magnitude larger, and also the larger KOCs or KDs, they have much greater retention potential. And that's what we're observing in the measured data for the field sites.
Perfect. We have actually a high flux of question, but we will have to move on now. So, Mark, if you please, I think we mentioned about how to answer the questions
Yes.
for attendees. So, if you spend some time, please scrolling through the questions and answer them in the Q&A pod there.
Will do. I'll try my best.
Thank you.
Thank
Thank you very
you.
much. Yep.
Stopping share.
Okay, so next we have Matthew Farrell, a PhD candidate working in the plant chart lab at the North Carolina State University. Matthew's research involves utilizing a zebrafish model to characterize the toxic effects of a wide range of individual PFAS and mixtures. Matthew, please feel free to begin when you are ready.
Okay, absolutely. Let me just share my screen. Okay, can I get confirmation real quick that everyone sees the PowerPoint?
Yes.
Okay,
Yes.
which is not the beginning of the PowerPoint. There we go. Okay, great. Okay, hello everyone. My name is Matt Farrell, and as stated, I'm a PhD candidate in the toxicology program at NC State. I'm working at the plant chart lab studying the toxicity of PFAS using zebrafish as an animal model. And my work really is just a small part of the extensive PFAS research currently going on at NC State as part of the Superfund research project. And today's presentation will be a slight change of pace from the other presenters today, as I'm just going to give you all an initial look at some data from some currently ongoing bioaccumulation studies that I'm working on, give you a little insight into how that's going. So, by now, I think everyone has at least a passing familiarity with PFAS, so I'm not going to go through the exhaustive background here, but I would like to share some information as it relates to what I'm doing. So PFAS are a class of chemicals containing over 8,000 unique chemicals. You'll see a few smaller and a lot of larger numbers relating to the number of PFAS as the kind of definition of what exactly constitutes a PFAS gets more refined. And as we're constantly discovering more byproducts, that number does go up and up and up over time. Despite the huge number of PFAS present, only a small number of PFAS have really been studied extensively. And for most of them, there is little or no toxicity data. Because they are widespread and because PFAS are highly stable in the environment, they have become ubiquitous environmental contaminants. This applies both to novel PFAS that are still being used frequently today, as well as older PFAS, which have been phased mostly out of production. You've probably heard the statistic that 99% of tested Americans had detectable levels of PFOA in their blood. And additionally, in today's surveys of environmental studies of wild animals, PFOS is typically the most commonly found PFAS, despite the fact that it was phased out of production over 20 years ago in most industries in the US. So PFAS, you know, are widespread and continue to be a threat even long after they have been emitted into the environment. So over on the left here, you can see the map of PFAS contaminated sites from the Environmental Working Group. And there's a lot of drinking water and military sites as well, largely due to their use of PFAS in firefighting foams. And hopefully this conveys how widespread around the country this problem really is. And of course, taking into account that really most of the gray spaces here with no dots are just because we haven't looked for PFAS there yet. I think in a more exhaustive survey of the country really would reveal a lot more contaminated sites than we're currently aware of, affecting more communities that we currently do not know are being affected. That said, while PFAS are really a global issue, they are a particularly heavy focus here in North Carolina. This is due in large part to the detection of PFAS at multiple sites in the Cape Fear River in 2016. Most notably, there were extremely high levels of Gen X, which is a novel PFAS, which at the time had barely been studied. The Cape Fear River watershed provides drinking water for over a million people in North Carolina. And so the discovery of Gen X and other PFAS in the river obviously was a major public health concern. This has spurred a great deal of scientific investigation into the prevalence and toxicity of PFAS, as well as a large amount of community activist organizations that have played crucial roles in research and policymaking. Today, a number of steps have been taken to reduce the output of PFAS into our waters, as well as improving our ability to remove PFAS from contaminated waters. But despite that, concerns still exist. We are still able to detect PFAS, albeit at lower levels, throughout Cape Fear River. And of course, there are many health concerns about people who were being unknowingly exposed for years and years before these chemicals were detected. So as part of the effort to address these concerns, the Center for Environmental Health, Environmental and Health Effects of PFAS was established between NC State and ECU in order to address concerns related to the presence of PFAS in the Cape Fear River. And so the center is comprised of a number of different projects, from those looking at human exposure, thyroid-related health outcomes, and community outreach, as well as projects focused more deeply on mechanistic studies, specifically immunotoxicity, the bioaccumulation of PFAS in aquatic food webs, particularly those in the Cape Fear River, as well as mechanisms for the removal and remediation of PFAS from contaminated waters. So a number of projects have been established to kind of tackle this problem from different angles. So the work I'll be sharing with you today is part of Project 3, looking at PFAS bioaccumulation and impact on aquatic food webs. So typically when people talk about PFAS, drinking water is the main concern that people are usually talking about. And as far as we know, for most affected communities, that is the largest exposure route. However, I do think it's important when discussing PFAS to keep in mind that these chemicals are ubiquitous, and we are being kind of constantly exposed through a number of different sources and through a number of different uptake methods. Right. So while PFAS may be emitted directly into water, which we then drink, that same water is also taken up by plants and other animals, which in turn enters into the food chain through our food supply. Emissions of short chain, more volatile PFAS can be carried through the air, where they can either be directly inhaled or settle back into the water, into the soil, into dust, which in turn can be ingested, inhaled, or contacted. As well as, of course, there are many consumer products containing PFAS, such as receipt paper, nonstick cookware, and all kinds of stain-resistant products like clothing and furniture, which can provide yet another point of contact for PFAS. So our project is focusing on the bioaccumulation of PFAS in particular. So this has been a major topic of study, especially for PFOA and PFOS, which are kind of older PFAS that have been studied a lot more heavily. Evidence has shown that plants and animals are able to readily uptake most PFAS through water, soil, and food. And once PFAS have been absorbed into an organism, many of them persist for an extremely long time. The long half-lives of these chemicals can drive bioaccumulation even at low exposure concentrations. Longer chain PFAS and those with sulfonic acid head groups seem to be particularly bioaccumulative. Many studies examining PFAS concentrations in wild populations have found that animals at higher trophic levels consistently have elevated levels of PFAS compared with other, compared with their environment, as well as other plants and animals in the same area. Even large predators like wolves and polar bears, which are typically located far from humans and from known point sources of PFAS, will often have high PFAS levels in the liver and serum, really indicating that these pollutants are ubiquitous and that they do concentrate up the food web. And so we, in particular, have been looking at aquatic food webs as our source of bioaccumulation here. The PFAS crisis in North Carolina is largely a response to high levels of PFAS that are detected in the water. And so research has focused on areas more likely to be affected by that contamination event. Fish are, of course, a major food source for many people, both in the affected areas of North Carolina and around the world. In particular, freshwater fishing is often used as a supplemental food source for low-income communities near fresh waterways, which makes those communities particularly vulnerable to exposure via freshwater fish. Additionally, fish are a well-known vector for biomagnified pollutants. Most people are probably familiar with other things such as mercury, PCBs, dioxins, all of which can be found at very high levels in fish at high trophic levels, due largely to the fact that they are sort of doubly exposed to aqueous contamination via both uptake through the gills in the water, as well as through their food from contaminated food sources. And because fish are so often victims of highly biomagnified contaminants, it is important to study this bioconcentration so that we are aware both of how to protect the health of wildlife as well as protect the health of people that are reliant on those fish as a food source. So now that I've gone through all that backup, I can jump into kind of the actual lab experiments that we're running here. So what we've done is kind of set up a model food web using a Periphyton mayfly zebrafish model here. So as you can see, sort of starting at the bottom of this diagram and working our way up, we have contaminated water. And then the next step there is periphyton. So periphyton really is a kind of catch-all term for algae, cyanobacteria, other microbes, as well as dissolved leaf litter. Basically, if you've ever looked in a freshwater stream and seen just kind of on, you know, that brown gunk that grows on the sides of rocks and things in the stream, that is periphyton. It forms the basis of a lot of freshwater food chains and serves as a major food source for a lot of aquatic insects, including mayfly larvae. So mayflies, of course, you're probably more familiar with as fly insects, but they do have an aquatic larval stage, which spends a significant amount of time growing and feeding in an aquatic environment. And then as our kind of top trophic level, we use zebrafish, which will eat anything that they can fit in their mouths. And so they're willing and eager participants in feeding studies with mayfly larvae, which they will happily eat for quite a while. And so then to describe the actual procedure here, we initially ran just a 5-day time course with water and periphyton to monitor uptake of PFAS into the periphyton. After that, we introduced mayfly larvae and allowed them to feed on the periphyton for 3 weeks. And then following that, once the mayfly larvae had grown to an acceptable size, they were collected and then fed to adult zebrafish in a single feeding event, where fish were free-fed as much as they would eat in one sitting, after which we collected half of the fish immediately for analysis, and the other half were fasted for an additional 24 hours to give them time to clear out their gut contents of any remaining mayflies, so that we could separate out PFAS that was just traveling through the gut versus PFAS that was being actually absorbed into the fish. Okay, and so looking at this figure, we've got kind of the results of that first 5-day exposure that I was telling you about with PFDA being absorbed into the periphyton. And you can see pretty clearly that there was effective absorption of PFDA by the periphyton just within the first day. Almost all of the PFDA present in the water has been taken up into the periphyton, and that trend continued at a slower rate over 5 days. So we definitely saw very efficient uptake of PFDA by periphyton. Looking also at PFHXS, the other PFAS that we studied there, we saw uptake as well, but obviously in this case, much slower uptake compared to PFDA. So while we did see some transfer of PFHXS into the periphyton, it was clearly a much less efficient uptake compared to PFDA. So following these 5 days exposure, 5-day exposures, then we added mayflies into each of these and allowed them to feed for 21 days. So jumping back to PFDA, we can see that concentrations after 21 days of feeding are now higher in the mayflies compared to the periphyton or the water. And interestingly, the average concentration of PFDA within the remaining periphyton has dropped significantly. So the possible explanation for that would be that, if you recall, periphyton is kind of a group of many different microorganisms. Possibly certain organisms within that grouping of periphyton uptake PFDA more readily than others. And so if those same organisms are also the preferred food of mayfly larvae, that might explain why the average concentration of PFAS in the remaining periphyton drops after the mayflies have fed on it. Looking back at PFHXS, we again see a similar trend, although with much smaller changes overall. wherein again the mayflies ended up being the highest PFAS concentration after the feeding experiment. And we saw, again, that slight decrease in concentration in the remaining paraphyton. Worth noting, because it is a little harder to tell because the visual distance between the two is less, the trophic transfer factor, so basically the ratio of PFAS detected in the mayflies versus detected in the paraphyton at the lower trophic level, was actually about twice as high with PFHXS versus PFDA. So while there was less movement of the sulfonic acid PFAS into paraffin in the first place, it was more efficiently transferred up the food chain to mayflies. So following our mayfly exposures, then we were able to proceed into the last step here, where we went ahead and collected these mayflies to feed them to zebrafish. So briefly here, we've got both PFDA and PFHXS on the same graph now. And we're comparing the total mass of PFAS detected within these fish versus the number of mayflies eaten by each fish. So you can see here that there is a pretty clear correlation here, especially with PFDA, between the amount of mayflies ingested and the amount of PFAS that we're detecting within these fish, indicating that basically that both PFAS were being effectively transferred from the mayflies to the fish. So next, I'm going to jump ahead and show you the exact same data, but split into two more categories now, separating out between the fish that were collected immediately after feeding versus those that we gave 24 hours to purge their gut. So in this case, the light red and light blue dots here represent those fish that were collected immediately versus those with the darker dots were allowed to clear out their gut first. And hopefully what is pretty apparent here is that these groups mostly overlay directly on top of each other, and that allowing fish to clear their gut made very little difference to the final PFAS concentrations detected in these fish. And so thus, that is an indication then that PFAS were not only being eaten, but were being very readily absorbed in the gut, when fish that had their gut cleared out had no significant difference in bodily PFAS burden compared to those that had. Yeah. And then broadly, the conclusions that we took from that so far would be that both PFDA and PFHXS are readily taken up from water by paraphyton, although PFDA appears to be absorbed to a greater degree. Both chemicals additionally move up a trophic level to mayflies through their feeding on the paraphyton. And between the two chemicals, PFHXS concentrated more heavily in mayflies compared to PFDA. Both chemicals were readily transferred to zebrafish through feeding, and we detected significant correlation with the quantity ingested for all fish. And lastly, both PFDA and PFHXS appear to be efficiently absorbed from the gut of zebrafish, indicating that that is likely a significant source of PFAS exposure. So obviously, this is just some initial data on an ongoing project. So just to lay out some future directions briefly here, more studies similar to the ones that I've just outlined are currently underway, testing a number of legacy and novel PFAS that we can get some more data points comparing newer PFAS to see how they bioaccumulate compared to the ones that we know are older and more toxic. Additionally, we are currently performing a number of chronic exposure studies with zebrafish using PFAS mixtures at concentrations similar to those detected in the Cape Fear River. And those fish are being used for liver proteome analysis. We know that the liver is a common target of PFAS toxicity, and so we are interested to see what kind of effects chronic low-dose exposure at environmentally relevant concentrations will have. And additionally, those same fish are being sectioned and analyzed in order to determine the partitioning of PFAS into different compartments within the zebrafish to hopefully better understand how different PFAS partition differently through those fish. So with that said, I would like to thank all of my lab members who have helped with this, as well as members of the Buckwalter lab that we have collaborated with. All mass spectrometry was done by the Metric Analytics Corps, NC State. And of course, funding for this research was provided by a Superfund research program. Wouldn't have been possible without them. Thank you very much. And can we move on to questions?
Perfect. Thanks, Matt. Very, very exciting. Yeah, we do have a question or more. So let's take it one by one. So we start with this one. Is there any evidence that the newer PFAS will be less bioaccumulative than the previous chemicals?
Yeah. So that's an interesting question. So as a general trend, the goal with the novel PFAS has been the introduction of ether linkages, as well as using shorter chain compounds. So based on what we know from other studies so far, at least, it seems that typically shorter chain compounds are less bioaccumulative than longer chain compounds, and compounds containing ether linkages, so in oxygen inserted into the backbone, are typically less bioaccumulative than those without. That said, there are still plenty of sulfonic acid containing PFAS being used today, which tend to be more bioaccumulative. And while the trend has been towards shorter chain PFAS, there are absolutely still PFAS being used today that are quite long chain PFAS, which we might expect to accumulate more. So I expect to soon have more actual data from more of these studies to better answer that question, but that's kind of what I would guess based on what we know so far.
Thank you. Okay, so people always dream about a general solution. So regarding the model that you used, how applicable is this specific food chain that you tested to a more general scenario?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And of course, obviously this particular food chain was used in part because of the practicality of these animals within a laboratory setting. And it is also interesting because as we've looked at different PFAS and different animal models, we do see a pretty wide range of half-lives of different PFAS, as well as uptake efficiencies of these PFAS within different species. And so I don't want to be too bold in saying that the data we see here can be universally applied to any other food chain or any other kind of bioaccumulation. But that said, the general model that we have here with periphyton as a basic food web, followed by aquatic insects, followed by fish, is a very common model in freshwater streams, such as those affected by this disaster. So we think this is basically about as relevant as a model as we can choose, but we do acknowledge that it may not be universally applicable because there are very large species-specific differences.
Okay, so more specific questions maybe about background water and conditions that you picked. So was the Cape Fear River contamination levels traced to any source, like a chemical manufacturer for specific compounds, or were the levels closer to background typical residential use levels?
Yeah, so good question. So there, basically, yes, a lot of the contamination was traced to a fluorochemical plant on the Cape Fear River run by Chemours. Specifically downstream from that plant is where we saw the huge concentrations of Gen X in the water. That said, there were also PFAS detected upstream of the plant, indicating that while it was clearly a major source of contamination, there are still other PFAS sources responsible for contamination there. Initially, I should point out, I think I hinted to it in some earlier slides, but didn't directly say maybe that there have been a lot of steps taken since the initial findings to reduce emissions from fluorochemical plant into water.
So to the same point, and then coming now to your study, how the concentrations that you picked for your study plan are relevant to the actual concentration in the river?
Yeah, absolutely. So the concentrations that we ended up using were elevated from what you would see in a normal environment. And we did want to use more elevated concentrations because due to the nature of our study where the final step involved only a single feeding event with zebrafish rather than allowing them to free feed over a longer period, we wanted to make sure that we were using high enough concentration that we would still be able to see if PFAS were transferred up the food web from just a single feeding event. That said, the levels here, while certainly higher than average, are not that unreasonable for a few extremely highly contaminated regions that have been sampled. So certainly not indicative of the overall water quality there, but it is not unheard of for contaminated sites to be at levels higher than we were testing with here.
So two questions that I'll combine. One is about the method. Were the zebrafish analyzed, like you analyzed the whole body or just the guts? And then a relevant question here, are certain organs in the fish target or accumulate different species of PFAS? And have you considered any like PFAS retention in the fish tissues or organs?
Yeah, good questions. So to answer the first question there, we analyzed whole body PFAS concentrations of these fish after the feeding. So with, I guess, all the talk about the gut that I was doing, the difference there would be half the fish. Basically, we allowed 24 hours to clear any remaining food out of the gut. So we were just trying to make sure that we were only measuring what was actually incorporated into the fish with those samples. And then to the second part of that question, so yes, there is evidence from other studies that PFAS in fish, as in with a lot of other organisms, tend to accumulate heavily in the blood as well as the liver. But specifically, we are also following up on that with our own study, looking at the partitioning of PFAS throughout the fish. We just don't have the data back yet from that, but I look forward to sharing that when we do. But yeah, that is something that we're considering looking at, absolutely.
So regarding the organism itself, were there any size or gender differences in the fish that consumed more versus less mayflies?
Yeah, great question. So we actually did look at sex differences in the fish, and we didn't find any significant difference specifically tied to sex. So generally, female zebrafish tend to be larger than males at adulthood, and additionally, larger fish in general eat more than smaller fish. But when controlling for size, at least we don't see any difference really between the males and the females. And additionally, we didn't see any health effects in the fish after uptaking the mayflies, although we wouldn't necessarily expect to over such a short time frame, especially given half of them were collected immediately after eating and the other half only a day later. So would have taken an extremely, extremely high dose to expect to see acute toxic effects over such a short time frame.
Some I would call it, you know, the critical reviewer questions about controls that you have used, and did you consider any losses by PFAS, some of them, especially if you talk about the longer chain PFAS and stick to vials. And so have these considerations been taken into your planning phase and your experiment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. yeah. So we are aware of the issues of PFAS adsorbing things, especially working in nanogram per liter range like we are. It can definitely significantly affect concentrations. And so, yeah, we attempted to account for that in the planning phase. And then the numbers shown here were actually verified via mass spectrometry. So the numbers shown in those initial water concentrations were actually not quite what we had initially targeted with those, but these are the kind of actual numbers that were verified to be in there after the fact. So Yeah, we think adsorption affected our concentrations so that they were slightly lower than what we were targeting, but we took measurements after the fact basically to try and account for that and get the actual concentrations that were present there. I think that addressed the question.
Mm-hmm. Another, I would say it's relevant about like controls and how did you like interpret the data. Do you have like a sense of whether the uptake of PFAS compounds into the fish like primarily like via food or directly from water or both?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for this experiment in particular, I guess I don't actually know if I clarified when I was going through things, but the mayflies were removed from the contaminated water source and fed to the zebra fish in separate clean tanks. So for this experiment in particular, the majority of the fish's exposure certainly would have come through the mayflies that we were fed. And we did also, of course, have some negative control fish that were not fed anything, which actually did still have some trace background levels of PFAS, because they really are everywhere, even when you're trying not to expose things. But yeah, the overwhelming majority of PFAS detected in these fish, we're confident, came from the food rather than from water.
Yeah, I remember seeing a study that PFAS was detected in the fish food that you use in the labs. So mm-hmm. As you said, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, we have higher flux of questions than we can cover. So Matt, please, thank you first. But if you can just go to the Q&A pod and answer the questions that we received so far, we would really appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Okay, so last but not least, we will hear from Dr. Carla Eng, an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Pittsburgh, with a secondary appointments in environmental and occupational health and chemical and petroleum engineering. Dr. Eng's research interest includes the toxicokinetic modeling to predict bioaccumulation and tissue distribution of PFAS, and her presentation today will highlight a case study in Pennsylvania. Dr. Eng, I will now turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the program, for the invitation to speak today. And I want to thank the two previous speakers for setting me up really nicely. So what I'm going to attempt to do is kind of take the very fundamental molecular insights from Mark's first talk and the observations of accumulation in organisms and food webs from Matt's talk and try to see if we can bring those two together and explain why it is that PFAS accumulate in the way and the organisms that they do. And I will also try to highlight a little bit about the work that we're doing in our local region towards the end. So I will start by acknowledging my research group because they are the ones who do all the hard work. I have a number of graduate students, postdoctoral scholars, and undergraduate researchers that are almost all, save one, actually, that's no longer true. They are now all actively working on PFAS-related projects, and I do want to acknowledge our funders. We get funding from a variety of sources, including the NSF, the USDA, CERTIP, that does a lot of work around PFAS, and of course also the SRP. And I want to acknowledge specifically two students, Mel Marcifke, who is a chemical engineering student who's getting her PhD in my lab. I'll talk a little bit about her work towards the end, who is funded by an R01 through the SRP, and Shan Niu, who is a postdoc in my group, and she's been doing work on an R21 to respond to a recent contamination event in our region that I'll talk about briefly towards the end. So just to give everyone a little bit of a flavor of the kinds of things we do in my research group, it includes a lot of PFAS toxicokinetics and toxicodynamics research. Basically, we build these physiologically based toxicokinetic models that try to understand how processes like protein binding result in the observations that you see about PFAS bioaccumulation and tissue distribution in different organisms. We also use both in silico and in vitro methods to try to better understand the structural features of PFAS that leads to specific types of toxicity. In addition, we do a lot of predictive modeling of PFAS biomolecule interactions. So how do PFAS interact with different types of proteins? Could we use the protein binding of PFAS as a means to develop innovative new sorbents to remove them from drinking water, especially for the PFAS that don't work well with traditional sorbents, like the short chain PFAS? We do a lot of research now on transporter impact from PFAS toxicokinetics, and I'll talk a little bit about that work. And then whether we can actually engineer new enzymes for PFAS degradation. And in order to do that, we need to be able to model PFAS well. And so one of the SRP-funded projects we have is to develop better PFAS simulations by improving force fields for PFAS molecular modeling. There are students in my group who focus specifically on human exposure via food. So if we understand that PFAS bioaccumulate in food webs, humans are usually the top predator in many food chains. And so bioaccumulative PFAS is of concern, but we don't only do PFAS in my group. So we also do some work on pesticides, POPs, and veterinary drugs, as well as PBDEs, flame retardants in farmed fish. And then finally, we have some emerging new projects, including an R21 that are focused on regional PFAS contamination issues. Western PA compared to other parts of Pennsylvania is relatively unexplored with respect to PFAS. But there was a recent AFFF spill in a small town in Pittsburgh called McKeesport. And we are also doing some regional mapping to better understand the impact of the industrial activity in this Rust Belt city and how it leads to potential PFAS contamination. So today's, because I don't have a lot of time, I'm going to basically focus on two things that I think fit well with the previous two talks. One is a focus on PFAS biomolecule interactions and PFAS phospholipids and protein interactions, and how they can help us understand PFAS bioaccumulation potential and toxicokinetics. And then I'll spend just a little bit of time talking about this McKeesport AFFF spill. So I'll start out by talking about observations, and this is very general, but something that was already mentioned by Matt, that suggest PFAS are not your average bear when it comes to bioaccumulation and tissue distribution, in that they seem to have very species-specific and PFAS-specific behaviors in organisms. So the first observation that was made about these chemicals that stuck out when compared to other persistent organic pollutants is they have preferential accumulation in specific tissues, especially liver and blood, and they do not accumulate in storage lipids, which is where we usually look for repositories of things like PCBs and DDTs and other neutral organic contaminants. And so the understanding of bioaccumulation potential for PFAS really required a new understanding of where to look, how biomonitoring should work, and what we should expect in terms of different types of PFAS and their accumulation potential. Another thing already mentioned by Matt is this very species, large differences across species and bioaccumulation potential. And we think part of that is driven by differences in the biological half-life or the toxicokinetics for these compounds. And this is just an illustration from extracted data from a paper in 2019 that shows on a log scale the PFAS elimination half-life in days for different PFAS that clearly shows there's a general trend of increasing half-life, and along with that, increasing bioaccumulation potential with increasing chain length, but also that for a single compound like PFOA, you can see order of magnitude differences across species. And even within single species, like the male versus female rat, you see order of magnitude differences in their half-life. So there's both sex, species, and chain length dependent differences on PFAS behavior inside of organisms. One of the major hypotheses for why PFAS are so bioavailable and some bioaccumulate and cause toxic effects is that, at least for the very well studied perfluoroalkyl acids like PFOA, they have a lot of structural similarity to fatty acids that are important molecules in the body for our energy and all sorts of different processes that depend on our ability to metabolize them. The problem being that, of course, PFAS are not metabolizable. And so we have something that can interact with the machinery in our bodies that is built to process fatty acids, but that can't or can only partially process the fluorinated compounds. And so we look into fatty acid carriers in the body to understand what those potential interactions might be. And those are things like serum albumin, which carries the less soluble long chain fatty acids through our blood, and fatty acid binding proteins that work inside of cells to shuttle fatty acids from the cell membrane into organelles for further processing. And this starts to give us some clues of why PFAS accumulate in the tissues that they do and some of the toxic effects they may have once they're there. The other piece is the membrane, which is very important for PFAS disposition, not just because PFAS can look like membrane lipids and therefore find their way into the membranes in that fashion, but also because they interact with a number of organic anion transport proteins that help shuttle them into and out of cells. And that shuttling seems to be partially responsible for the species and sex differences that we see in PFAS half-lives. And I'll get into that a little bit as I move forward in this talk. So just to reiterate that PFAS don't behave like your traditional neutral organic compounds. We've had decades of success using KOW and LogP to model the bioaccumulation potential of other neutral compounds. And we do understand, as I think Mark very clearly explained, the hydrophobicity of PFAS, which is partly explained by their molar volume, for example, is one of the major drivers of their behavior, but not the only driver. And so if you use only LogP or KOW to try to predict what's going to happen in an organism, you can't get there. So this is from one of my earliest forays into trying to model PFAS, a measured LogBCF versus predicted LogBCF. And showing that you cannot predict the bioaccumulation potential of PFAS if you only use LogP. So this X is sort of what we would expect it to look like based on LogP of the chemical, and the filled circle is what you actually measure. And so the bioaccumulation potential of PFAS, especially consider that most of them are charged at environmentally relevant pH, is orders of magnitude higher than what would be expected. And so that led myself during my postdoctoral work, and then when I started my group at Pitt in 2016, to try to build up our knowledge of what these other processes could be and how we can apply them to better modeling PFAS behavior. Oops, and I did not do my animations in the right order here. So here's another paper that I think was very telling, and this is from Clifton Dasenkow in Elsie's Sunderland's group at Harvard, that was looking at the accumulation of different PFAS compounds, both short chain and long chain, in pilot whales. And they also found in that study that the accumulation trends and the trends across different PFAS showed very specific tissue distributions, and that this tissue distribution not only seemed to coincide with what we already knew about proteins and accumulation in the liver, but also showed some concerning trends. For example, the ability of very long chain PFAS to cross the blood-brain barrier and accumulate in brain tissue. And that seemed to also point to not just the influence of proteins, but also the influence of phospholipids. The brain is a very phospholipid-rich tissue. To explain the overall patterns of PFAS bioaccumulation. And that led us to really understand that there are multiple tissue-specific components that need to be taken into account if you want to develop predictive models for the many structurally diverse PFAS that are out there. And so my group has therefore been working in different areas to try to build up and fill in some of these key gaps to understand PFAS biological fate. That includes building tissue-specific description that really identifies and then models the key phases that are driving the accumulation of phospholipids. And so we've been looking, for example, at breaking tissues down into very simple boxes. I'm an engineer. We like to model everything as boxes. So can we describe each key tissue in an organism as a combination of phospholipids, active proteins, structural proteins, and potentially also the membrane active transporters that are important for accumulation and uptake. Building in dynamics, both dynamics in protein expression and dynamics in transport activity, because organisms are not static, we're not at equilibrium with our environment. And so every time there is an uptake where there is a change in an environmental parameter, this can lead to changes in protein expression that will have important influences on toxicokinetics of these compounds. And so This was a collaboration with Jackie Bangma and Teresa Guillet that was a really fun paper where we looked into what are the factors in the environment that actually influence protein expression, how might that change physiological behavior and concentration of some of these key pools for interacting with PFAS, and how would that then lead to altered PFAS tissue distribution. As I'll talk about in a little bit when I discuss transporters, there is the potential here for inverse causation conclusions, drawing the wrong inference about what we see, to say that PFAS impacts some biological system when in fact the PFAS toxicokinetics are changed due to changes in that biological system. So understanding the direction of that relationship is very important. And as Matt already discussed, because of the differences that we see across different organisms, can we use a zebrafish to model all ecosystems? Can we use a zebrafish to model humans? Are rats or mice better models for certain disease states? How do we decide based on what we know about differences across species? So one of the fundamental pieces we're working on is this trying to break an organism down into boxes to make predictive models that work for multiple PFAS and multiple organ systems. And so a lot of the work we've been doing is to build up this in silico framework, which we are then parameterizing using a combination of in silico and in vitro work to describe different organisms like the kidney, the liver, the muscle, in terms of these key pools for interactions with PFAS. So if we look at, you know, in a more realistic scale, the fact that these biological systems are made up of interactions between the blood and the tissue, where the tissue is really described by the interstitial fluid, intracellular fluid, the membranes, the proteins inside the cells. And we break that down into these components and the relative fractions available for each. So we get something that's actually closer to a KOW or a log P, but that includes these specific interactions. And so we are envisioning being able to build tissue fluid partition coefficients that take into account the impact of phospholipids, of structural lipids, of active proteins, phospholipids, storage lipids, structural protein, and functional protein. So proteins where we have specific interactions versus protein like in the muscle that we know don't interact much with PFAS at all. And so in order to do that, we're building up our in vitro evaluation of more structurally diverse PFAS. So this work was pioneered by Stephen Droege, who published a series of papers in the last 2 to 3 years where he started looking at both serum albumin and phospholipid interactions with different PFAS. And so the open symbols here were published by him. And so we've taken basically his methods and are extending it out. Here I'm showing just the PFCAs, PFSAs, and some fluorotolamide sulfonates, but we have a wider suite of structurally diverse PFAS compounds we're doing this with to begin to try to understand what we expect to see in terms of the chain length of the PFAS, the different structural features, whether it is a carboxylate or sulfonate, for example, and the membrane water partition coefficient. So how much of the bioaccumulation potential we're seeing is just because PFAS associate themselves with the cell membrane. And then we're doing the same thing with different proteins, including serum albumin, to build out our database so that we can start to make these tissue fluid partition coefficients for multiple PFAS. And so here, this plot doesn't look like anything, and that's by design. Or not by design, but we're kind of glad that it does, and I'll explain why that is. So we have been looking at two pools that we know are important for PFAS bioaccumulation. One is human serum albumin, and the other one is phospholipid membranes. Because there's been this discussion back and forth across the literature, is it protein binding, is it phospholipids that are leading to the observed bioaccumulation of PFAS? And what we have found is that there is a relationship between PFAS chain length and or PFAS head group and the strength of binding to different proteins. And there's also a relationship between PFAS structural features and membrane water partition coefficients, and they're not the same. So what this kind of scatter plot figure is trying to show you is that there's no strong correlation between the membrane and the protein PFAS association. which suggests there are different mechanisms that influence the chain length and structural features at play. And actually, this is good news because it shows that these are complementary and not redundant data. So the observations of association with membrane water are there and they are true, and the associations with proteins are there and they are true, and you kind of need both of them to get the full picture. And so it basically motivates us to include both of these components in trying to model the overall organism distribution of these compounds. Where it is less important is in when you consider other lipids and proteins. So other lipids are the storage lipids. That's what we find in our adipose tissue. This is why you don't see PFAS building up, at least the well-studied PFAS building up in fats. They have very, very low distribution between octanol and water because they're mostly charged at environmentally relevant pH, and charged things don't like to be in neutral lipids. And structural proteins, so these are like the proteins that make up the bulk of your muscle tissue, also have very low interactions with PFAS. And this is based on partitioning of organic ions into muscle protein, which was a polyparameter, a linear free energy relationship method that was developed recently by Henneberger, Goss, and Endo. And I think that it's important to acknowledge that not all proteins are the same, because I think when PFAS were first introduced as being proteinophilic as opposed to lipophilic, we thought we could, okay, just look at muscle tissue or just look at total protein content in tissues to predict where they would go. And that really doesn't work because structural proteins are not good adsorbents for PFAS. So here you can see for PFOA, which, you know, I hate having to bring up over and over again plots for PFOA because we keep saying in the literature, stop studying PFOA. We have enough data. We need to study the other PFAS. But just here as an illustration, because we have so much information about PFOA interactions with these different types of pools, storage lipids, phospholipids, structural proteins, and binding proteins, we can build a description of the different tissues that includes the contribution of these different pools to the accumulation potential, right? So this is, think about this as like a partition coefficient on the y-axis on a log scale. So this is almost like a log P. And so anything above zero means a tendency to accumulate in that phase. Below zero means it prefers the aqueous phase to that phase. And so you can see that the binding proteins and the phospholipids are by far the major drivers. And depending on what's around in that tissue, where you have more of these binding proteins, they become more important. Where you have more of the phospholipids relative to binding proteins, then the phospholipids become more important. So it really depends on the composition of the tissue. Unfortunately, the binding proteins in other tissues are incompletely studied. So we need to understand more about binding about protein structure, how their endogenous ligands can help inform us whether PFAS would tend to bind to them or not. So future needs here are really to find more functional proteins that could bind to PFAS based on what they're normal binding to. Also to understand the influence of membrane transporters, which I'll talk about really briefly. And then use all that information to inform tissue partition coefficients for a broad scale of other PFAS. So here, for example, we now have enough data to do the membrane water partition coefficients from Droege's and our in vitro work. And so now we're working on building out this specific protein component. And so to get beyond the PFCAs, because there are so many different PFAS to study, it's going to be really hard to do this as is the traditional way to do it on a chemical by chemical basis. So we have to pick representatives of different structural groups intelligently and then do a combination of in vitro and in silico work in order to have an efficient means to build up this information, but to be able to cross-validate with at least some members of each class, the in vitro and the in silico, so we have more confidence in our results. So I'll talk really briefly about trying to understand key differences across species and ecosystems because I want to plug a really cool application from the US EPA that everybody should be looking at as it's very interesting. And the first is how do we figure out which model organisms are good for a particular purpose? Which proteins should we be looking at? Which PFAS? So Carly Lalonde, who's been collaborating with us for a few years now, helped develop this CECAPAS program, which is basically started out by taking the gene sequences of proteins across different species and comparing them in order to see where the differences were. And working with her, we did some molecular modeling simulations to compare between our molecular modeling predictions and the CECOPATH predictions to try to understand how different typical model organisms accumulate different PFAS. So here we were looking at liver fatty acid binding protein that we think helps explain liver accumulation of these compounds, and trying to understand differences between these model organisms. And the humans here are in blue. If something is significantly less, binds less strongly than the human, it's shown in red. And so you can see that the humans are generally the most sensitive species, which is unfortunate for us. But it really helped us to validate some of the hypotheses that came out of CECOPATH. We did find some differences that had to do with the protein shape. So we wanted to be able to kind of refine this approach. And following our collaboration with Carly, she actually picked up our method of using molecular dynamics and kind of ran with it and updated this framework. And the new CECOPATH uses protein structure, not just protein sequence, to help model differences across different species. So I would urge people to go and look into this. This is a cool paper that she led talking about this next frontier in chemical safety evaluation that utilizes this to really understand protein structure and its influence on interactions with all chemicals, not just PFAS. Okay, and I'm going to do this real quick because I know I'm almost out of time. It's important to also consider dynamics. So not only just the differences across species, but also how the environment and health states can impact expression of different proteins. And we wanted to understand how not just proteins influence PFAS toxicokinetics, but how do differences in protein expression then lead to different influences of PFAS. So this was work that was led by the postdoc in my group, Shan Yu, and she was working on trying to understand how kidney health impacts our ability to uptake and excrete PFAS and how that leads to differences in PFAS half-life in humans. Because we see that there is renal reabsorption of chemicals like PFOA that lead to very long half-lives in humans and also lead to sex differences that are observed between male and female rats. And so this review paper that was published earlier this year in EHP basically looks at what are all the membrane transporters that have been studied that are important in the kidney for PFAS uptake and excretion in urine. And then what are some potential ones that have not been explored that could potentially also be important? And then what are the differences that are observed between humans and rats, which are the two best studied organisms? And what she was able to show is that protein levels for these transporters change with both acute and chronic kidney injury. And depending on which part of kidney function is disrupted, this can lead to really different half-lives. And PFOA half-life can either increase or decrease depending on which transporter or which process in the kidney is changed. And so that really shows that in order to identify particularly vulnerable populations, it's really important to take into account how the overall system health leads to changes in these key proteins and transporters. And she's now working on in vitro studies to basically increase our knowledge for different PFAS and different transporters so that we can help build up these models more predictably. Okay, I think that I am mostly out of time, so I am not going to have much time to talk about this McKeesport study. I actually think I'm going to skip it so I have time to do more of the questions, but I will mention that PFAS was not on the radar in the city of Pittsburgh very much until recently, where there was an accident that released AFFF directly into the drinking water system. It went into a fire hydrant and entered the distribution system of this town. And we've basically been trying to do some work to figure out what has happened to the contamination in the time since. So if you're interested in PFAS in drinking water and this sort of unique case, please follow up by email, and I'd be happy to chat about this a little bit more. So the last thing I want to highlight is just because this fits into the molecular modeling work we're doing, we are trying to understand whether we can engineer enzymes for PFAS destruction by starting out with one of the few well-known enzymes, chloroacetate dehalogenase, that can actually defluorinate these molecules. and trying to improve molecular models for PFAS so that we can understand and trust the predictions better. And if you're interested in this, we have an almost hot off the press paper that was just accepted this week in the Journal of Chemical Information and Modeling that is all about mechanisms and opportunities for design of enzymes to degrade PFAS. And we're hoping we're at the proof stage. So we're hoping this will be online probably late next week. If you're interested, please do come and listen, come and take a look. And then I know that we are kind of towards the end. So if I don't get to answer your question by the end of the Q&A period, please feel free to shoot me an email or find me on Twitter. And I'm happy to answer additional questions there.
Thanks, Carla. Very, very exciting. And I'm actually looking forward to reading your upcoming article.
Thanks.
Okay, so we have some questions. So given the thousands of PFAS that need to be evaluated, how can we feasibly include so much complexity in describing their biological interactions?
Yeah, I think about this a lot because the lure of log P is that it's one number, right? And you can use one number, one property of the chemical and have a pretty good idea where it's going to be in the environment. Mm-hmm. And I think that we can get there for PFAS, but it's going to be a little bit more like a PPLFER where we have, there'll be multiple components that feed into that. And so we're just needing to do the hard work to compile all of those values for the different structural features. And we're hoping that then that will reduce down to something that we can predict across different types of PFAS. But I think we're just not there yet because there are so many ones that haven't been tested. So it's going to take some legwork before we can come up with that one number for the different PFAS.
Yep, thank you. So this is a very interesting question. Since shorter chain PFAS were introduced because of their shorter biological half-lives, hasn't this solved the major issue with the PFAS exposure?
Yeah, and I think actually Matt tackled a similar question about whether, you know, do the shorter chains bioaccumulate less? And in general, they mostly seem to. PFHXS, which is not really a short chain, for some reason is an outlier that seems to be very strongly bioaccumulative. But I think the bigger problem is that PFAS are so persistent that even if they don't bioaccumulate, because they are constantly in the environment, we're still being re-exposed over and over and over again. And so I think one of the issues is if a shorter chain compound is less bioaccumulative, but still toxic, because of their persistence, it can still have an impact.
Mm-hmm. So there was a mention of mapping industrial sources in the city. Can you speak on how this being done? How are you identifying industries that manufacture and use PFAS?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So there's been earlier work, not from my group, that have put some of these PFAS maps together. And I think Matt actually showed the EWG map that is pretty famous on the drinking water sites. And following on from that, there's been work on identifying industrial sources. And one of the papers that I helped contribute to was a paper by Juliana Gluga that tried to find what are all the known uses of PFAS in different industries. And so we basically use that as a touchstone. So her paper identified 200 different uses of PFAS in different industries. And so we basically went through all those industries and then we looked for records and permits in Western Pennsylvania for companies that are associated with those industries and started putting those maps together. And we have just begun processing some soil samples we've taken around those areas to try to identify PFAS associated.
Yeah, thank you. Now a deep dive in a molecular interaction. So the question says, have you considered that the fluorine in PFAS as a halogen may be displacing iodine in particularly in thyroid tissues and other tissues where iodine hypothermia is in human is often complemented by unexpectedly low iodine levels?
So. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I have not myself looked into this. I do know that PFAS do interact with some thyroid hormones. So there have been studies looking at PFAS interactions with TTR, for example. And I would need to know more about whether that iodine being displaced is the ion. And then that would depend on what type of PFAS you've been, because there are some PFAS, some precursor PFAS that could be metabolized and potentially release fluoride ions, but this is not the norm and certainly not what we think about in terms of like PFOA and PFOS exposure.
So yeah, I promise that I will read your upcoming article, but related to the questions relate about like PFAS degradation or microbial or enzymatic PFAS degradation, where are we now and how far are we to get something out of that specific direction? Because compared to other degradation techniques, this is a kind of still emerging compared to other like existing and mature technologies.
That's right. So I think that there are a couple of enzymes that have been studied. This fluoroacetate dehalogenase is one, but it can't do anything more than like a difluoroacetate. So it's pretty limited. And then horseradish peroxidase is something that was studied early on, is still the subject of some study where they have found microorganisms actually capable of degrading PFAS. They know the microorganism, but they haven't identified the enzyme yet. So it's very early on. And I think that what we do know is maybe something about specific reactive oxygen species. So, for example, hydrated electrons seem to be very effective at breaking down PFAS. So it's kind of like, how can we find sources to create some of these species using enzymes that would help us move forward? Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the reductive reaction there that you mm-hmm. need to utilize. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So circling back to the first question about like, the magnitude of the problem in number of PFAS. But there is another issue which is related to the mixtures. So data on single compounds and their toxicity and bioaccumulation, that is very much needed. But also now there is an increasing interest in the mixtures, either for toxicity or other evaluation for mixtures in general. So do you have any ongoing work on that, or how do you see it in general?
Yeah, we do this from two different perspectives. One is we have some work where we're looking at PFAS that are found in food contact materials. And so we've been collaborating with folks at the USDA where they actually do extractions of food contact materials. And we look at the mixtures that come out, and then we expose zebrafish larvae to those mixtures to see if it's different from what you would find for a component, you know, the individual components, because we're interested in looking at more realistic exposure settings. The other is from a mechanistic point of view, we would want to understand if there is an interaction, what's driving that. And so the main way that we do that right now is to look at whether there's competition between long chain and short chain PFAS for protein binding sites. So we do some of that work that's ongoing. Yeah.
Okay, so last question. Do you see precursor degradation in human body to terminal PFAS?
Yes. So I don't see it. there have been studies, and the thing, I'm not sure about in human bodies because we can't really do human studies. So with humans, we're always trying to infer whether we see that happening, right? So we know what people are exposed to and we know what we find in their blood, but we can't actually track the reactions. But there have been studies where they've exposed, for example, fish to either eftos or fluoroethylene or carboxylic acids, and then they can find the accumulation of the terminal acid in their body. So we do know it happens in organisms.
Perfect. Thank you. So I think as the time allows, if you can please check the Q&A pod and answer the questions there, because now it's time to conclude. And yeah, thanks a lot for sharing all of these amazing insights with us. Okay, so before we conclude, let's have a look on our seminar homepage. So this website will be active from today on and contains important resources such as links to download our presentation materials, contact information for our speakers, more information about the Superfund research program, and links to our feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and deliver mechanism. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. And here are a variety of links to learn more about Superfund research program. I encourage you all to check out the various components on their website and learn more about the program and initiatives. Next slide, please. Now I would like to remind participants that of the various pathways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any of our webinars. So for more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the link, the CLUIN.org website. You can also subscribe to the monthly newsletter in TechDirect. We encourage you all to visit the SRB Risk e-learning webpage, check out our monthly research brief, and subscribe to the Risk e-learning listserv for information about upcoming sessions. You can also follow the SRB on X, formerly Twitter. Next slide, please. I would like to encourage everyone to join us for the last session of this webinar series on November 8th, and feel free to review the recording of our first session on October 6th. Available scan is a QR code that will take you to the webinar homepage. And if you are unable to attend, don't worry, an archive will be available shortly after each session and will include the session recording and our speaker's presentation. With that, it is time to conclude today's session. Thanks a lot for your participation, and thanks to our presenters today for their time spent for preparing and sharing their work with us today. Have a good rest of your day.